Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today, we kick off another year of the Strategy Snapshot podcast series with plenty to talk about. In just 2 weeks is President-elect Trump's inauguration, which will bring significant policy changes. Investors are also keenly focused on inflation and whether the Fed will be able to continue to cut rates. So joining us today to provide a level set on the outlook, glad to welcome back for our first episode of 2025, Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, welcome back. Happy New Year. Nice to be with you this morning. Looking forward to our conversation.
Good morning, Dan. Happy New Year. Hope you and all of our listeners were able to have some relaxing time off and kind of came back to start the new year fully recharged and ready to deal with what's likely to be another exciting and certainly interesting your financial markets.
Likewise, Jason, and there is indeed a lot to talk about. Though before we get into what's ahead of us, I know it has at this point been 3 weeks since we concluded 2024 with our final snapshot of the year. So can you begin with a quick recap of market performance since then and how markets are now positioned at the start of 2025?
Well, if I were to sum up what's happened in the past 3 weeks since we last spoke, the real story in the markets is the rise in interest rates. In particular, the 10-year Treasury yield is up about 20 basis points over the past few weeks, the same layer with the 30-year yield, whereas the 2-year yield is up only 2 basis points. And the catalyst for this was the Fed meeting, the FOMC meeting on December 18th, where they cut rates 25 basis points, but did so in a relatively hawkish manner. And we'll get into more of the details about that shortly. That contributed to some choppy equities over that time period. So we got a rally early in December, but we didn't really get the full Santa Claus rally going into, you know the Christmas holidays and year end. 3 weeks ago, the S&P 100 closed at 6,074, and ended up falling about a little over 2% over the past couple of weeks. The cyclical parts of the markets lagged. The small caps were down 4% over the time period. And for the month overall, an equal-weighted measure of the S&P 500 lagged the overall S&P 500 index, the market cap-weighted index, by about 5 percentage points. So that kind of really reflects the concerns of if the Fed's not going to be able to cut rates, rates are going to be higher for longer. That certainly weighs on the more economically sensitive parts of the market. And we saw that performance play out post-FOMC, but really kind of for the month overall. That wasn't the only factor. The Fed wasn't just the only game in town. The fiscal story of what's happening in D.C. with the incoming Trump administration was also a factor. On December 20th, a continuing resolution to fund the government, it was set to expire. The expectations were that there'll be another continuing resolution passed that would go into at least March. That ended up being the case, but the path getting there was more difficult, perhaps, than people were assuming, investors were assuming. You saw disagreement within the Republican Party. A proposal that was initially put forward was kind of rejected, by Elon Musk and others. That's ultimately led the Republicans to reject that before kind of a smaller deal was done. So it sort of highlighted that the assumptions about a red sweep outcome, the policy changes, things aren't going to be kind of smooth sailing. There'll be some challenges to getting that done. I think that also added some uncertainty to the markets. It's also important to keep in mind that this is a very quiet time of the year. Liquidity is low. Any sort of news and small movements in the markets can be amplified because of that. What we've seen end of last week, once people started to come back after the New Year's, is that equity markets and risk overall sort of bouncing back. Investors are getting kind of re-engaged. Well, what did happen over those past couple of weeks is positioning sort of lightened up overall. Sentiment and sort of the euphoria that was taking place, in early December, that got dialed back a little bit. Until this morning, as we talked, there's a Washington Post article suggesting that Trump and the administration, incoming administration, is considering universal tariffs in only select sectors. So already kind of reducing some of the tail risk that investors were fearing. So a little bit choppy over the holidays. It wasn't quite the year end or the holiday rally that it's maybe typical. But as we reengage, I think the story sort of somewhat remains the same. But clearly today versus 3 weeks ago, the main difference is, you know, the Fed looks to be a little bit more hawkish than investors were assuming going into the meeting back on December 18th.
That's a good point. Let's run with that a bit further. So since we last spoke, we did have the December Fed meeting. At that meeting, the Fed did cut rates by 25 basis points. However, the messaging was hawkish. As you pointed out, yields have risen. What are your expectations now for Fed rate cuts in 2025?
Well, the messaging, you know, was hawkish. And the simple way to look at that is it's like the dot plot, which reflects the various committee members' expectations for how much the Fed will cut rates next year. Going into the meeting, it was the median dot implied 100 basis points of cuts next year. After the meeting, it went down to 50. The market knew it would kind of go from at least 100 to probably 75, but still some thought that that's the, you know, the direction of travel. So to go to 50 was maybe a little bit surprising, but even more significantly, only not five of the 19 committee members see more than 50 basis points cuts, and four actually see, you know, 25 or less, or no cuts whatsoever. So when you kind of, you know, add that up to where it was, that's a relatively kind of hawkish signal, but also just noteworthy. It's a minor detail, but for 2024, there was also expectations, you know, among committee members for how much the Fed would cut. Four dots were at only 75 basis points of cuts. There was dissenter, one dissenter at the FOMC meeting in December of like basically dissenting on 25 basis point cut. But three other people basically were signaling by the dots that, you know, the Fed should only cut by 75 basis points, meaning they shouldn't have cut by 25 in December, even though they didn't officially dissent. So overall, a relatively, you know, hawkish outcome. And that was the key catalyst for what caused, you know, rates to go higher, and it caused some of the indigestion among risk assets over the following, you know, days up until very recently. The CIO view, as a result of the FOMC meeting, is that we now expect the Fed to cut 50 basis points, with a 25 basis point cut in June and again in September. A March cut is possible. It could be back on the table if the data, especially in the labor market, is weak and inflation comes in lower than, you know, some concerns about. It could be hot again for the start of the year. But ultimately, why 50 basis points this year? One reason is that we expect core inflation to slow. The core PC engage that the Fed really focuses on is at 2.8% based on data through November. You know, the target certainly is 2%. You know, we expect it to slow at about 2.5% by June. Again, that would, and the trend would be lower. So that gives the Fed sort of cover to be able to cut again. Also, well, the labor market is strong. It's on a clear softening trend. That's something that Powell, the Fed chair, Jay Powell, cited during his comments in the press conference. And the Fed policy that is still in the restrictive territory suggests that trend should continue. You know, and to avoid much more soft in the labor market, the Fed will have to continue to ease at some point. Just for perspective, the market is pricing about 1.5, 1.6 cuts this year, the full cut by June. So we're expecting a little bit more than what the market is pricing. And we will see very soon, you know, as the data comes in, whether a March cut is perhaps back on the table, where the Fed is going to sit and wait, and particularly also see what the policies are from the Trump administration and how much they could contribute to either slowing growth and or, you know, higher inflation that would cause the Fed to either be more aggressive in cuts or ultimately maybe slow down cuts if the economy is getting a lot of stimulus or inflationary impulses.
So with that, Jason, if we now turn focus to the incoming Trump administration, policy announcements through executive action are expected to start almost immediately after President-elect Trump's inauguration takes place. Now, in your latest blog, Jason, which is titled MAGA versus Doge, you do suggest within that there are competing economic ideologies reflected by MAGA and Doge. So what are those ideologies in your view, and how does it inform your view on what to expect from Trump 2.0?
Well, you know, all investors right now are wondering what economic policies, you know, the Trump administration will you know, implement. We expect higher tariffs, you know, an extension of the expiring tax cuts, deregulation, stricter immigration. Those are all likely, but of course, their magnitude and sequencing are critical. But in order to maybe formulate an overall investment view, I think it's helpful to also ask, like, you know, will the Trump 2.0 economic ideology be more MAGA or more Doge? So, you know, you said MAGA versus Doge. I'd sort of say it's MAGA v. Doge, which is a small thing, but it's, you know, there's clearly a range of views within the Republican Party of what is the right economic policies. And so it's not an either or. It's a kind of more of a spectrum. One of that, of course, spectrum is, you know, MAGA, which the way I kind of define it is a populist America first approach. It's aiming to help people who haven't benefited from economic prosperity the last 20 or 30 years. And this could be achieved, you know, to help these people by, you know, applying higher tariffs to get more manufacturing back into the U.S., less immigration, and implicitly sort of more government spending through, you know, government support, so larger deficits. And at its essence, I think MAGA policies ultimately entail a more activist role for the government to achieve these ends. And it includes really kind of a distrust of, you know, big institutions, also, you know, big business. In contrast, you know, the specific aim of DOGE, the entity that's being created, is to reduce government spending and shrink the deficits. And sort of ideologically, I think it favors the private sector to create prosperity, not the government. And another way to think of it is MAGA is kind of rejecting globalism. You know, the key attribute of globalism is maximizing economic efficiency. You put up production where it could be most efficiently and cheaply produced. It's rejecting that, whereas DOGE is very much about the efficient delivery of goods and services. So another way to think about it in really basic terms is that MAGA is ultimately trying to benefit labor and workers. DOGE is probably a little bit more favoring capital all sequel. Now, these characterizations are, of course, simplifications, and they can be challenged. Yeah, but I think the fact that there was 2 weeks ago an online debate among MAGA and DOGE adherents, like all sort of within the Republican tent at this point in time, about the merits of immigration, you know, I think illustrated the point that as economic ideologies, they are distinct. And so the really, when it comes to, you know, why does this matter? You know, going back to like, you know, what is an overall investment view? I'd say that the more DOGE-like that the policies from the Trump administration are, the more constructive it is for the investment outlook. And ultimately this matters because what really, you know, is important from a medium or long-term view is, will these policies have a positive impact on aggregate supply, you know, through deregulation, you know, for your markets, for your better allocation of capital, or they will sort of restrict supply, and, you know, tariffs, for example, are a way of doing that. The better you have on terms of positive supply side reform, the more you can sustain growth at current levels while also allowing disinflation to continue. And ultimately, I think, you know, the case for DOGE to me is slightly stronger. You know, for one, you know, there is a Trump put in the stock market. We saw that during his first administration. And so in some way that kind of limits how much the policies can favor labor over capital. There's also, I'd say, a second Trump put that we've discussed on this podcast before for treasuries. A Trump put on treasuries would keep rates from rising too much, which we know is a negative for the economy. It's a negative for equity markets. That really means less reflationary policies, in some way less, you know, kind of, you know, large deficits, all equal, smaller deficits, less inflation. That would be positive in that regards. And then third, for all the talk about sort of MAGA being a populist movement, if you just look at what happened during Trump 1.0, his first administration, is a fairly conventional Republican economic policies with large tax cuts, deregulation, and tariff increases, you know, were modest except on China. So if that is, you know, ultimately kind of the policy path, that is more DOGE-like instead of, you know, MAGA-like if you take, you know, everything sort of literally in that case. Now, the pause to policy clarity implementation is likely to be longer and more fraught than investors were assuming even 2 months ago when they first saw the red sweep outcome. And, you know, keep in mind, there's a very narrow Republican majority in the House. It's only one seat for the you know, short term. There's a range of views. You're getting something done, you know, with the debt ceiling now expiring, with the continuing resolution to fund the government up until March 14 expiring. You know, the idea of a smooth sailing, I think that's a little bit optimistic. And so we'll see within the party itself, tensions between where on the spectrum of kind of different views do you want to lean. And ultimately, you know, my conjecture would be they're going to lean more towards DOGE or market-friendly outcomes. And the news this morning about more maybe selective sectors would be impacted by a universal tariff is already kind of in line with that general thinking.
So if we turn back to the markets based on these Fed and Trump administration policy forecasts you've shared with us, Jason, how do you expect markets to perform at the start of the year?
Well, for the time being, markets might lack some clear direction until the policy path comes clear, you know, meaning sort of range-bound equities and range-bound rates. We may know these priorities, you know, by the end of January, like even in, you know, day one, based on some executive orders. But to actually get the policy outcomes, like actual deals done, that could take, you know, quite a bit longer. So if markets are somewhat range-bound, they can swing within these ranges as investors get new information. They assess what policies are likely, you know, and sort of update, you know, good or bad from the market's perspective. One thing I will say is any sort of, you know, kind of sell-offs or pullbacks in the markets, these dips, they'll be bought, you know, supported by the fact there is a Trump put, there is a Fed put out there, you know, if the economy kind of slows too much. Unless investors really start to believe the economy is headed towards a recession or stagflation, I think people will kind of step in and buy. And we saw that last year. There's no reason to think at this point that necessarily will change, which does mean that, you know, market volatility and these market swings could happen very quick. So any sort of, you know, sell-off off of any negative news and high inflation, you know, something that could be, you know, negative in terms of tariffs, markets could sell off very quickly, and then aggressive dip buying could result in this coming back also very quickly, similar to what we saw last summer when, you know, it took about 2 weeks for the S&P to be down almost 10%, and then, you know, in about 2 weeks it rallied almost entirely back. That could be sort of like in the story for this year, especially as we get this policy kind of clarity. And the final thing is, in terms of just overall maybe equity market performance, there's a lot of concerns about the breadth of the rally last year. That may be continued to be somewhat narrow for the time being, especially if inflation remains sticky, Fed cuts are in jeopardy, and the policies from the Trump administration look to be inflationary, or they could be inflationary. And we saw that, as I alluded to earlier in my comments, that the equal weight S&P kind of lagged the overall market, the small caps lagged the overall market. So people are kind of leaning, investors were leaning more towards the large mega cap companies, the growth stocks, the quality companies, just out of concern for what all this means for inflation, what it means for interest rates going forward. So until there's more comfort about the trend is that rates go lower, as we expect ultimately, the market breadth and equity market breadth might be a little bit still narrow before broadening out takes place later in the year.
So with those near-term market expectations in mind, Jason, if we close out with asset allocation, what's your guidance with respect to what investors should be doing at the moment with portfolio preparation for the new year?
Well, our baseline view for the economy is a combination of solid growth and gradual disinflation, the Fed cutting rates by 50 basis points this year. That's all directionally positive for risk assets and financial markets overall. And if the Trump administration policies are more Doge-leaning, that again is also generally going to be favorable for the financial markets. Our price target for the S&P at year-end is 6,600, so a little bit more than 10% upside from current levels. We still feel kind of comfortable, you know, given the macro conditions and the earnings outlook for that to happen. You know, until we kind of get the policy clarity, there certainly can be some choppiness and sideways movement in the markets. The sooner that resolves, the sooner the markets can certainly move higher. Within equities, tech, you know, still remains the most attractive sector. AI, you know, that theme we think has good sort of runway. And one story that within the AI world, you know, that could evolve this year is a broadening out perhaps from the AI infrastructure plays to start to see as the year goes on more of the AI adoptions or AI agents will probably be a buzzword this year. So again, the AI tailwind has as a secular theme, has good runway. Within fixed income, rates are sort of range bound. They certainly could go higher near term, which is why we prefer, you know, intermediate range of duration, like more like 5 year, 7 year, as opposed to extending much out to 10 or beyond. On the rise in rates just over the past couple of weeks, you know, has indicated why we were sort of more cautious about taking on too much duration risk. We still sort of remain in that camp. Probably better entry points to really extend duration, you know, as rates move higher. And given spreads are quite tight, you know, still prefer kind of being up in quality, not taking a lot of risk, especially with these yields where they are. Your all-in yields for high-quality fixed income, it can be 5.5-6% without taking a lot of credit risk. So no need to take too much risk there. And as a bit of a hedge to what has been a relatively kind of positive overall outlook for the markets, we think gold has decent upside. It's a hedge. If we're wrong on sort of inflation, we're wrong on the geopolitical front or even the domestic policy front, it's a kind of a potentially good hedge for portfolios this year as well.
Well, Jason, very productive conversation to begin a new trading week and a new year. So thank you for dropping by, spending some time today with our listeners and our clients, and do look forward to picking back up with our conversation in the week ahead.
You're welcome. Have a great week and have a great year, Dan.
Likewise, Jason. Thank you very much. Again, today we have been joined by Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Before we close out, again, I do want to point out Jason's latest blog, which he has been making reference to during our conversation today. That title, MAGA v. Doge, is available now up on UBS.com/CIO. For clients of UBS, simply reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of Jason's latest blog directly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit UBS.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit UBS.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.